Good morning once again. It's nice to see you here for the Bible study. We will continue in God's timeline in history. Before we get started, if you'll bow your heads, I'll ask God's blessing. Heavenly Father, we come before you and pause before you to ask for your blessing and inspiration on this Bible study, that you would inspire both the speaking and the hearing, that we would learn from your word, that we would act on it, and that we would gain a greater grasp of your plan as we study your revealed timeline of history that shows how you have worked in your people's lives down through time. We commit this and pray it in Jesus' name. Amen. So for the third time, I'll say good morning. Just to make sure that I get it right, and we're not in the afternoon. We continue in God's timeline of history, and of course, this is not the politically correct view. But it is, in fact, God's timeline, and I think it is important for us to understand and have a framework to see how God worked with specific individuals and circumstances through time. Hence, we have this timeline that we have developed in the church over the years that is not all-inclusive, but as we have been going through this, it highlights some of the major events that shaped biblical history. The last time we concluded with Moses being disqualified from entering the Promised Land. That event, I think, is very instructive. I was listening to the radio this morning coming up, and the commentator was talking about, you know, some people that think that if you're basically a good person, no matter what your religion might be, that somehow when you die, everything's going to be okay. I mean, the whole thing is very tentative, but, I mean, this is the viewpoint of many. When you think about Moses, who was used powerfully by God to lead millions of people out of captivity in Egypt to the Promised Land, who was in so many respects faithful and a dynamic leader, and then he made this one little error, and yet God was just. And while Moses clearly is going to be resurrected and be in the kingdom of God, we have that assurance in the scriptures. God still was just, and because of that infraction, his punishment is the right word, but the consequence is the word I wanted to use. The consequence of his not following God in that particular instance was that he was not able to go into the land of promise that he had led the people to. So, point number 51 in his timeline is Joshua was selected to replace Moses. And I want to try to cover a little bit more ground today, so we'll go a little bit more rapidly. But that's found over in Numbers chapter 27. And I'll begin reading in verse 12 with Joshua being selected to replace Moses. Now, the Lord said to Moses, "Go up into this Mount Abarim, and see the land which I have given to the children of Israel. And when you have seen it, you shall be gathered to your people as Aaron your brother was gathered. For in the wilderness of Sin, during the strife of the congregation, you rebelled against me. You rebelled against my command to hallow me at the waters before their eyes." So the issue was that Moses was to speak to the rock, and in doing so, hallow God's name and his sovereignty by being able to make water come out of a rock by just speaking to it, which was, you know, quite different from hitting it with his rod. Because, you know, the physical impact of the rod, someone could have concluded, well, you know, this was really a rock that was like an eggshell, and you split it open, and water came out. So Moses, being frustrated, understandably, with the rebellious Israelites, fell into rebellion, as God puts it here himself, and did not follow his command. Then Moses spoke to the Lord, saying, "Let the Lord, the God of the spirits of all flesh, set a man over the congregation who may go out before them, and go in before them, who may lead them out and bring them in, that the congregation of the Lord may not be like sheep which have no shepherd." So Moses was concerned that leadership, that God would select leadership to lead the people so they would not be without a leader, which would be like sheep without a shepherd. And it just doesn't, without leadership. I mean, John Maxwell, who is a kind of a leadership guru, says that everything rises and falls on leadership. And of course, whenever you make a superlative statement like that, I mean, you could argue, well, does it always? But the essence of the statement is, in fact, true. I mean, if you look at countries, if you look at organizations, and you look at their success and failure, it is in some way connected with leadership. Whether that be a group of individuals or a individual, where there is no leadership, organizations flounder and fail just like sheep without a shepherd, scatter. And the Lord said to Moses, "Take Joshua the son of Nun with you, a man in whom is the Spirit, and lay your hand on him." So here you see the transference of authority through the laying on of hands. And we note that in Joshua was the Spirit, meaning the Spirit of the Lord. And it was through the power of that Spirit that Joshua and Caleb were able to stand up and make a case for invading the land as God had commanded. Of course, they were overruled by others, but there was a different spirit in Joshua and Caleb. Continuing, "Set him before Eleazar, the priest, and before all the congregation, and inaugurate him in their sight." I mean, it's interesting that even in our country, presidential inaugurations occur in the sight of the people. There is a public ceremony in which powers are inaugurated or conveyed upon the individual that is to take on a leadership position. This was done back then as well. "And you shall give some of your authority to him, that all the congregation of the children of Israel may be obedient. And he shall stand before Eleazar the priest, who shall inquire before the Lord for him by the judgment of the Urim. At his word they shall go out, and at his word they shall come in, both he and all the children of Israel, with him all the congregation." You notice here that while Moses laid hands upon Joshua, that he was only to give some of his authority to him. And a differentiation that is mentioned here is that while Moses talked face to face to the Lord, Joshua was to inquire of the Lord through Eleazar the priest. So there was a difference here in how God communicated to Israel or to Joshua, although, I mean, later the Lord appeared to Joshua as well. But the primary thing here was to go through the priesthood to gain access to the Lord. Verse 22, "So Moses did as the Lord commanded him, and he took Joshua and set him before Eleazar and a priest and before all the congregation, and he laid his hands on him and inaugurated him just as the Lord had commanded by the hand of Moses." So in this way, Joshua took on the mantle of leadership, and that was a major event in the timeline of history. The next one that is worthy of mention is the death of Moses. Go back to Deuteronomy chapter 34. Numbers, Deuteronomy 34. I'll begin reading in verse 1 and then drop down. Then Moses went up from the plains of Moab to Mount Nebo to the top of Pisgah, which is across from Jericho. And the Lord showed him all the land of Gilead as far as Dan. Been on that mountain. And it's up high, and you can look westward and see the whole range, all the way, as it says here, from the north to the south on a clear day. It's, of course, sobering and thought-provoking to stand on that mountain. Now, of course, they built monuments of where Moses stood. Whether or not the exact location is accurate is probably very debatable. But it is the same mountain nonetheless. And I think this is something that is important with respect to the Bible. Most of the geographic locations mentioned in the Bible are verifiable. You know, you can go there. And many things have now been verified by archaeology as well. So it's not just some, as many would have you believe, not just some fairy tale about, you know, kind of like the Wizard of Oz and the Yellow Brick Road. You know, if you've, you know, people talk about that and the Yellow Brick Road and all that. But if you ever been there, that is a fable. The Bible is not. Continuing in verse 5, so Moses, the servant of the Lord, died there in the land of Moab, according to the word of the Lord, and he, being God, buried him in a valley in the land of Moab, opposite of Beth Peor, but no one knows his grave to this day. God did not want his grave to become a shrine, because he knew that the children of Israel, being their inclination would have been to somehow enshrine him and perhaps even worship him. Moses was 120 years old when he died. His eyes were not dim, nor his natural vigor abated. And the children of Israel wept for Moses in the plains of Moab 30 days, so the days of weeping and mourning for Moses ended. I mean, notice here, and I think, I mean, I have thought about this recently, because when someone dies today, and you know, it's kind of, you know, a fast food funeral, there is appropriate mourning that should take place. And in this case, it was a period of 30 days. And if you look at the biblical examples of people dying, there was a mourning period that was of some considerable length. It's often, I think, in our modern world, death is viewed as an inconvenience that happens, and, you know, let's get it over it so we can move on with our lives. And that's probably a little bit out of balance. So point number 53, Joshua leads Israel across the Jordan into the Promised Land. That indeed is a landmark event in God's timeline of history. Finally, after all these years, they were able to do what they should have done. You know, it was about a 40-day hike across the desert to get to the Promised Land had they gone there directly. It took 40 years because they did not believe God, because they continued to murmur and look back and rebel. And I look at myself and my life and I think, how much time have I wasted, you know? How much time have I wasted in my trek across the wilderness and not been able to, you know, fully benefit from what God might have wanted me to do? I think that's a question we should all ask ourselves, because I think every day we waste time that we should be redeeming. Okay, let's go to Joshua chapter 4. In Joshua chapter 4, Joshua is an interesting book, but, you know, after the days of Joshua, you know, into the period of the judges, again, it was kind of a situation where leadership was sometimes good and sometimes very bad. And again, back to the truism, everything rises and falls on leadership. You can see that play out. But let's take a look at Joshua leading into the Promised Land. That's over in Joshua chapter 4. And again, we're just doing highlights. So we'll pick it up in verse 15. Then the Lord spoke to Joshua, saying, command the priests who bear the Ark of the Testimony to come up from the Jordan. Therefore Joshua commanded the priests, saying, come up from the Jordan. And it came to pass, when the priests who bore the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord had come from the midst of the Jordan, and the soles of the priests' feet touched the dry land, that the waters of the Jordan returned to their place and flowed over all its banks as before. Now, if you've been to the River of Jordan today, it is a very different River of Jordan. It's about the size of Dowdy Creek, where we will be camping this week at Troyer's Hollow. It's very small, because most of the waters that would normally be flowing down the River of Jordan are getting pumped out of the Sea of Galilee to be used for irrigation. But that was not the case back at the time when the land was flowing with milk and honey. And what they did is they walked into the water with the ark, and the water backed up and drained downstream. And so they stayed in the middle until everybody had passed through and they came up. And of course, this served as this struck fear in the hearts of the people that they were about to conquer. Let's drop down to chapter 5 and verse 1. And so it was, when all the kings of the Amorites who were on the west side of the Jordan, and all of the kings of the Canaanites who were by the sea, heard that the Lord had dried up the waters of the Jordan from before the children of Israel until they had crossed over, that their heart melted, and there was no spirit in them any longer because of the children of Israel. I mean, they just panicked. And another thing from geographically here that, and it took me a while to kind of get this into my head, because you think of Israel being east of Egypt, east and north, Israel actually traveled east and then north and then entered Israel going west. I mean, they were on the east side of the Jordan and then crossed over to the west to enter into the Promised Land. But, you know, I think we would probably also take note, you know, if there were an invading army coming from the south, and you got to the Ohio River, and they just walk into the river, and it stops flowing and piling up towards Pittsburgh, and the riverbed dries up south to Cincinnati, and they just walk across. I think that would make news, and it would probably cause us to think twice as well, and maybe get a little bit shaken, as did the leaders of that time. Verse 2, at that time the Lord said to Joshua, make flint knives for yourself and circumcise the sons of Israel again a second time. So Joshua made flint knives for himself and circumcised the sons of Israel at the hill of the foreskins. And this is the reason why Joshua circumcised them. All the people who came out of Egypt who were males, all the men of war, had died in the wilderness on the way after they had come out of Egypt. For all the people who came out had been circumcised, but all the people who were born in the wilderness on the way as they came out of Egypt had not been circumcised. And it is just kind of an interesting observation. You know, here they were being led by God, and were in the wilderness, and yet they didn't perform circumcision according to command for that entire time. And people have asked me why, and I said, I don't know. They didn't. Probably, just because, like many things, they just didn't do what they were supposed to do. So Joshua had to catch up that after. And notice this was after they crossed the river, but before they kept the Passover and then officially entered into the land. Dropping down to verse 10, so the children of Israel camped in Gilgal and kept Passover on the 14th day of the month at twilight on the plains of Jericho. Here is another scripture that speaks to the Passover and whether it is to be kept on the 14th or the 15th day of the month. I mean, here Joshua was keeping the Passover not on the 15th day, but rather on the 14th day at twilight, which is when? At the end of the 14th day. And they ate of the produce of the land on the day after the Passover, unleavened bread and parched grain on the very same day. Now the manna ceased on the day after they had eaten the produce of the land, and the children of Israel no longer had manna, but they ate the food of the land of Canaan that year. So once they had crossed over, been circumcised, kept the Passover, they began eating the food of the land instead of relying on the manna. This was a very significant event. But as we will see in a few minutes, as in life, a major event like that doesn't mean, you know, everything's over and we just kind of move in. The conquest of Canaan took a period of many years as they traveled north and south under Joshua's leadership to drive out and supplant the peoples that God said the land would vomit out because of their depraved practices. Every culture, brethren, that has adopted depravity, moral depravity, has failed. We are in the process of doing that at a remarkable pace and calling evil good and good evil, and we will suffer the same fate. It has always been true. I just heard a report on the radio that in Belgium, if you are a pastor and speak out against homosexuality, they will remove you from the pulpit. That's freedom of speech in the Western world. Now, you can talk about anything else. I mean, you can broadcast the most obscene things, but you can't do that in Belgium. It's a very progressive, and there are other countries that are in the same boat. So the question is, what do you do? Didn't bother Paul in Romans chapter 1. Of course, he ended up being, quote-unquote, the Lord's prisoner. And those are the times in which we live. Let's see here. The next point is the tabernacle is pitched at Shiloh in Ephraim. And we're going to take a look at a couple of scriptures here. Go over to Joshua chapter 18. Again, I mean, you've got the fall of Jericho here, which was also a major event, and the defeat at the city of Ai, again, over what in our modern world seems like a quote-unquote minor infraction. I mean, he kept a little bit of the booty. But it was a big deal to God. And let's take a look here at the pitching of the tabernacle at Shiloh, because that kind of signified them having settled into the land. Verse 1 of chapter 18. Then the whole congregation of the children of Israel assembled together at Shiloh and set up the tabernacle of meeting there, and the land was subdued before them. So this marks an event. You've got the tabernacle now in the land, and the tabernacle remained at Shiloh for quite a long while. I think it stayed there, if my recollection is correct, until David moved it into Jerusalem. And of course, the tabernacle had its better and worse days, depending on who was looking after it. Let's go over to Psalms now, and Psalms chapter 78, I think, is kind of an instructive look back. Psalms chapter 78. Verse 55. He also drove out the nations before them. God did, he did that, and, he does that. He sets kingdoms up and he pulls them down, and, there is a spiritual component that, inspires peoples to do some remarkable things. Consider, just a week ago was the 70th anniversary of D-Day. You can look at the history and the politics and all the intrigue and stuff that went on leading up to and why America got involved in Europe again after having been tired of it from World War I. But underneath all that, there is a spirit that moves peoples to do things. And that was certainly the case. The world would be an entirely different place today. Just a completely different place if Hitler had succeeded in maintaining his hold of Europe. In fact, I think there is a book that was written by a German historian this past year. I heard about it and I meant to buy it and I didn't. About it's an imaginary book, and what the world would look like had that been the case. And I think it would have been an interesting read, obviously, and a lot of conjecture. But I believe that God moved the Allies to do that in order to shape history in the way that is consistent with his plan. Because how do you otherwise explain, the men being able to do what they did on the beaches that day in the face of fire? Look at us today. all we do is talk, and talk is cheap. It doesn't accomplish anything. And our enemies, the enemies of the United States, are being emboldened by it. That's just the way it works. It works that way in a schoolyard when you've got a couple bullies around. That's just the way it works in a world where man is attempting to rule himself. So here we see that God intervened and drove out the nations before them and allotted them an inheritance by survey. I'd forgotten about this. They went out, we'll read later, and actually surveyed the land. And made the tribes of Israel dwell in their tents. So far, so good. But then notice what happened. Yet they tested and provoked the Most High God and did not keep his testimonies, but turned back and acted unfaithfully like their fathers. They were turned aside like a deceitful bow, for they provoked him to anger with their high places and moved him to jealousy with their carved images. When God heard this, he was furious and greatly abhorred Israel, so that he forsook the tabernacle of Shiloh, the tent which he had placed among men, and delivered his strength into captivity and his glory into enemies' hands. He also gave his people over to the sword and was furious with his inheritance. The fire consumed their young men, and their maidens were not given in marriage. Their priests fell by the sword, and their widows made no lamentation. This was the consequence. And it is a universal dynamic of history. When nations embrace the depravity and immoral behavior, it weakens them and takes away the will to fight and to do. It is a natural consequence, and we see it here. Let's go over to Hebrews chapter 12 just for a minute. Hebrews chapter 12, verse 20, for they could not endure what was commanded, and if so much as a beast touched the mountain, it shall be stoned or thrust through with an arrow. And so terrifying was the sight that Moses said, I'm exceedingly afraid and trembling. So this is hearkening back to when God appeared to them directly. And then it draws a comparison to the tabernacle that we have access to. But you have come to Mount Zion and to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, to an innumerable company of angels, to the general assembly and church of the firstborn who are registered in heaven, to God the judge of all, to the spirits of just men made perfect, to Jesus, the mediator of the new covenant, and to the blood of sprinkling that speaks better things than that of Abel. While God departed the tabernacle, while God forsook the temple of the New Testament and allowed it to burn to the ground. And see, here's I think, a warning for us nationally as well as the church, is the Jews put their trust in the structure of the church, or the temple rather. They believed that somehow God would not allow the temple to be destroyed. You see, that is not important. That the physical structure of the temple was not important to God. That was not, shall we say, the deciding factor. The issue was whether or not his people, who claimed to be his people, were following and adhering to the principles that he had revealed to them. And of course, I mean, Jesus in Matthew chapter 23 upbraided the leadership of that time, because they had just become depraved and taught as doctrine the commandments of men while ignoring the greater principles of justice, mercy, and faith. I mean, the real meaning of it. It had become politicized to the point where they were paralyzed from doing the right thing. And at the In the end, in 70 A.D., the temple burned to the ground, because God is more concerned about the spiritual health of his people than any particular structure. Point number 55, Israel in the Promised Land. We go back to Joshua chapter 11. Joshua chapter 11, verse 16. So Joshua took all this land, the mountain country, all the south, all the land of Goshen, the lowland and the Jordan plain and the mountains of Israel and its lowlands, from Mount Halak and the ascent to Seir, even as far as Baal Gad and the valley of Lebanon below Mount Hermon. You know, Mount Hermon is a remarkable mountain, and there's a huge spring that flows from it. He captured all their kings and struck them down and killed them. Joshua made war a long time with all those kings. There was not a city that made peace with the children of Israel except the Hivites and the inhabitants of Gibeon. All the others they took in battle, and it was of the Lord to harden their hearts that they should come against Israel in battle, that he might utterly destroy them and that they might receive no mercy, but that he might destroy them as the Lord had commanded Moses. Again, I mean, this is a warning for us. And if we put our trust in our arsenal as a nation, instead of the principles of God, God will give us the same fate. And, you know, in this case, he hardened their hearts and swelled them with pride so they would go out into battle and then would get destroyed. And at that time, Joshua came and cut off the Anakim from the mountains, from Hebron, from Debir, from Anab, from all the mountains of Judah, and from all the mountains of Israel. Joshua utterly destroyed them with their cities. None of the Anakim were left in the land of the children of Israel, but, notice here, they remained only in Gaza and Gath and in Ashdod. And that's, of course, where Goliath came from. So Joshua took the whole land according to all that the Lord had said to Moses, and Joshua gave it as an inheritance to Israel according to their divisions by their tribes. Then the land rested from war. But notice, Gaza they did not conquer. And Gaza is what today? Still a problem for Israel. I mean, it just, it is a problem that remains unsolved to this day. They did not completely wipe out the inhabitants of the land. Let's go over to chapter 18. Chapter 18 in verse 6. You shall therefore survey the land in seven parts and bring the survey here to me that I may cast lots for you here before the Lord our God. Verse 8. Then the men arose to go away, and Joshua charged those who went to survey the land, saying, go walk through the land, survey it, and come back to me that I may cast lots for you here before the Lord in Shiloh. So the men went, passed through the land, and wrote the survey in a book in seven parts by cities, and it came to Joshua at the camp in Shiloh. So, you know, here, I mean, this is not unlike what happened to this country. I mean, the land upon which we stand today, you know, was part of the Western frontier during the Revolutionary War, and many of the people that settled, I know the history better too, or down in our way, came, the initial tracts were given to, after surveying it, to Revolutionary War vets in payment, in part, for their service. I think we too often think of these people as unsophisticated. Notice, they went, they surveyed the land. I mean, they measured it. And they wrote it in a book and brought it to Joshua in verse 9. And then Joshua cast lots for them in Shiloh before the Lord. And there Joshua divided the land to the children of Israel according to their divisions. And, of course, you can go out and get a map of what that looked like. And, of course, there are different versions of it. But I'm just pointing out here that it was done decently and in order, in an organized fashion. And they were sophisticated enough to measure the land and draw a map into a book so that Joshua could then assign it to the different tribes. They didn't have Google, they didn't have GPS, and they didn't have all these things. I mean, George Washington, when he surveyed the area up here, had a chain, and you would measure for miles and miles and drive in the stakes. There were means to do that kind of thing even back then. Going on to chapter 19, verse 49 and 50, again, under the point, Israel in the Promised Land. And when they had made an end to dividing the land as an inheritance according to their borders, the children of Israel gave an inheritance among them to Joshua the son of Nun. According to the word of the Lord, they gave him the city which he asked for, Timnath-Serah, in the mountains of Ephraim, and he built the city and dwelled in it. These were the inheritances which Eleazar the priest, Joshua the son of Nun, and the heads of the fathers of the tribes of the children of Israel divided as an inheritance by lot in Shiloh before the Lord at the door of the tabernacle of meeting. So they made an end of dividing the country. So the matter in that sense was settled. Now we come to the death of Joshua. The death of Joshua was a significant event. I mean, God did not select anyone to replace the seed of Moses, as he wanted Israel to do what they proved incapable of doing, and that is to live by faith and to look to him, God, as their king. Joshua chapter 24, let me see here. Let's go to chapter 24, verse 24 through 33, here at the end of the book of Joshua. And the people said to Joshua, "The Lord our God, we will serve, and his voice we will obey." I mean, this was a constant refrain of the children of Israel. They were willing, or at least they knew the right answer to the question when it came to, "Will you obey me?" It's kind of like a little kid, you know. You ask them, you going to do what daddy says? Oh, of course. Yep. I'll do that. And then, you know, things happen. So Joshua made a covenant with the people that day and made for them a statute and an ordinance in Shechem. Then Joshua wrote these words in the book of the law, and he took a large stone and set it up under the oak that was by the sanctuary of the Lord. And Joshua said to all the people, "Behold, this stone shall be a witness to us, for it has heard all the words of the Lord which he spoke to us. It shall therefore be a witness to you, lest you deny your God." So Joshua let the people depart, each to his own inheritance. So in similar fashion to the covenant that God had made through Moses, Joshua made a covenant with them, and they said that they would obey him. Now it came to pass after these things that Joshua the son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died, being 110 years old, and they buried him within the border of his inheritance at Timnath-Serah, which is in the mountains of Ephraim, on the north side of Mount Gash. And Israel served the Lord all the days of Joshua, and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua, who had known all the works of the Lord, which he had done in Israel. The bones of Joseph, which the children of Israel had brought out of Egypt, they buried at Shechem, in a plot of ground which Jacob had bought from the sons of Hamor, the father of Shechem, for 100 pieces of silver, and which had become an inheritance of the children of Joseph. Now verse 33, "And Eleazar the son of Aaron died, and they buried him in a hill that belonged to Phinehas, his son, which was given him in the mountains of Ephraim." So this kind of concludes a chapter. And it speaks to the problem of what is called generational creep, where through each successive generation, less and less is known about significant impacts and works of God, and the conclusion is always the same. I mean, I see that in my heritage, going back to the 16th century, when the Swiss Brethren stepped out and went far beyond what Zwingli and what Luther were doing with respect to Reformation. I mean, Zwingli and Luther went about to quote unquote fix the Roman Church. These guys saw that as being entirely insufficient and stepped out in what was considered a radical way to establish a church separate from the state that was guided only by the scriptures. And the first documented occurrence of that was in 1525, where a number of them were baptized as adults, which was anathema at that time. And this movement, the fires of faith burned intensely for a period of 50 to 75 years amidst much persecution. They got them kicked out. They got themselves kicked out of just about every place they lived. The three primary personalities that started the movement were dead within 2 years. Two were executed. One died of natural causes. But what happened that I found instructive, even as I was searching for the truth, what happened though with generational creep was the church that came out of that movement 100 and some years later, was a very different church than what the founders had envisioned. Their confession of faith was very different. And somehow it's kind of mass gotten lost in history and that is kind of forgotten. But if we carry that forward to us, the challenge that we have is to try to, and I think it is our responsibility, to try to prevent that from occurring today, if it has not already occurred, to preserve doctrinal integrity within the Church of God is extraordinarily important. Yes, I understand that, doctrine, absent love and administration can be problematic, but love absent sound doctrine, so-called love absent sound doctrine does not work. It just doesn't work. It's never been, the doctrinal truth has never been the problem. It is always correct and critically essential for the preservation of the church as an organization to be effective. The problem is always in its application or misapplication, as the case might be. And we see that here. Joshua carried the ball forward. He was a slave in Egypt. He was one of the two people that were men of war, that were adults when they came out of Egypt, that actually inherited the land. He experienced all of that, and as we just read here, he and the elders who served with him were able to carry it forward, and during that period, the Israelites served God. And when that generation passed, things passed with them as well. And then we have the book of the Judges. And we've got one more point here. the time of Judges, and we're going to look at two scriptures, or three maybe, as time may allow us. And I think it makes a very important statement about what I just said. Let's take a look at Judges chapter 1, in verse 1. Now, after the death of Joshua, it came to pass that the children of Israel asked the Lord, saying, "Who shall be first to go up for us against the Canaanites to fight against them?" And the Lord said, "Judah shall go up. Indeed, I have delivered the land into his hand." So Judah said to Simon his brother, "Come up with me to my allotted territory, that we may fight against the Canaanites, and I will likewise go with you to your allotted territory." And Simon went with him. So, I mean, Joshua had mapped it out, and Joshua had conquered in that sense, but as the population grew, they had to completely take control of the various areas. So, we start out well enough, but then we go over to, Joshua chapter 2, beginning in verse 11. "And the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord, and served the Baals." And some have said our modern fascination with sports that have round things, balls, you know, whether it be baseball, football, soccer, whatever. And, you know, it is, I suppose, a stretch, but I think it is also a fair statement to say that the absolute overindulgence in sports is a form of idolatry that, I mean, how else can you explain that, you know, a guy chasing a pigskin up and down a field, getting all beat up, makes more money than anyone else in a regular job can even think about? It's all because we watch it. And in a spectator sport, funds those kinds of activities. In this case, they were serving the idols Baal, and they forsook the Lord their God, the Lord God of their fathers, who had brought them out of the land of Egypt, and they followed other gods from among the gods of the people who were all around them, and they bowed down to them, and they provoked the Lord to anger. They forsook the Lord and served Baal and Ashtoreth, and the anger of the Lord was hot against Israel, so he delivered them into the hands of plunderers, who despoiled them and sold them into the hands of their enemies all around, so that they could no longer stand before their enemies. Wherever they went out, the hand of the Lord was against them for calamity, as the Lord had said, and as the Lord had sworn them, and they were greatly distressed. Then the Lord raised up judges who delivered them out of the hand of those who plundered them. So you have this, I mean, the story of the book of Judges is just this. They would follow other gods. They would become depraved and got into sexual immorality and so forth. And then God would punish them, and they would run and they'd go into captivity. And then they would cry out to the Lord, and then he would raise up a judge and would deliver them. It was a political situation that was very insecure. I mean, there was not much stability at all during the period of the judges. It was up and down and down and up and up and down. All because they were not abiding by the universal principles that bring stability. And, you know, you look at the Islamists that this week took over half of Iraq, and the barbaric, the absolutely barbaric manner in which they conquered. I mean, this is, you know, it's just history repeating itself and repeating itself. And for the undisputed superpower of the world to stand by and do nothing is just astonishing. It's just astonishing where we are at as a nation, because it would not have taken very much to to prevent all that from happening. And what do leaders do? They say, get together and work things out. Well, since when in human history has that worked? It is indicative of where we are at as a nation and where our will is, and we have lost the pride of our power. We are ashamed of it because we don't recognize that it was God who gave it to us in the first place. History just continues to repeat itself. Okay, we then conclude over in Judges chapter 17. And again, my comments earlier about the concept of generational drift, I think is borne out here. First, we'll look at Judges chapter 17, and then we'll go to the last one. Judges chapter 17, verse 6. Judges 17, verse 6. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Well, it seems right to me. And when you have a group of people where each man decides for himself what is right and wrong, it is assured chaos. No organization, no company can operate without some standardized, agreed upon ways to behave and operate. It just does not work. It just doesn't work. We conclude, or Judges, the period of Judges, which is where we conclude today, concludes over in chapter 21, verse 25, was basically the same statement. This was the political climate at the end of the book of Judges, before, you know, the kings came on scene. In those days, there was no king in Israel, and everyone did what was right in his own eyes. So it was from that platform that, you know, they approached Samuel and asked for a solution. You know, whenever there is, as was the case here, anarchy, what do? They ask for a strong hand from somewhere. The political dynamics remain unchanged today, and as we study God's timeline of history, we can learn a lot about today from looking back at history, because today is simply a repeat of lessons unlearned. If you'll bow your heads, I'll ask the blessing on the meal. Heavenly Father, we